This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station,
Joy 94.9.
While the rest of the nation sleeps, the dairy farmers of Rip Roa are up early and squeezing teats.
So what's today, mate?
So you're waking up at?
About 3.30.
3.30?
Yeah, 3.30. This time of year, it's a little bit cruisier. It's 4.30.
Rugby-playing dairy farmers aren't really the on-camera type, so having a film crew around must have been a tad weird.
It didn't take that long for everyone to get used to it, eh?
Yeah.
It was, mate, they were just a fly on the wall.
Yeah.
Chris and Aaron were. They were pretty cool, man. They just sort of, they blended in, eh?
Yeah.
Did what they had to do, I suppose.
But did the rugby-playing dairy farmers like the finished result? Or was it, well...
Nah, everyone loved it, eh? No one had an issue with it.
Just probably being hard and fair is probably the main thing, yeah. Just modern form of being a gladiator, I suppose.
It'd be quite good to have my own farm, be able to sit in a lazy wheel chair and not milk any cows anymore, have workers doing it.
I think I'm going to hang my boots up after the season. I said that a couple of seasons ago and I'm still here, eh, so we'll see.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10! How many other sports you can go to batter someone, tackle them, ruck them, and then afterwards you have a beer with them and your mates?
Yeah, for their relaxation, they go into battle.
And to injure themselves.
Party all night.
Potentially serious injuries.
Yeah.
Really, there's no padding. There's no softly with that.
No.
It's crunch.
It's crunch.
Don't know really why you play rugby, do you think?
He pulled a testicle.
I think it's to wake up the thirst for afterwards.
This is a culture, and it's probably the same in Australia to some extent, that, you know, men aren't allowed to show their vulnerabilities, to talk about their innermost feelings.
Hey, Robbie, you got to run. Honey, we make a tackle, we've got to get up, we get the ball, and we pass it. Who can do that?
Me.
I can't hear you. Who can do that? Okay, I get the message.
And then there's, you know, a punishment. So that might be, you know, I don't know, sculling this or that or whatever. There's various punishments.
Consumption of chili and Weet-Bix.
Yeah, and it just turns into this mad ritual. And for them, the purpose of it is to try and, you know, from that point move on and have a clean slate kind of thing.
Okay. Yeah, okay. And also it's a bonding ritual thing. And
This
is Sonia for Joy 94.9, and we're in the studio speaking to a couple of Kiwi filmmakers who've made a very intriguing, wonderful documentary about, of all things, rugby. What else? When it's talking about New Zealand, no. There are other things, including the best spreadable butter ever, fish and chips, and all those other stereotypes. And of course, rugby. And we've got Chris Pryor and Miriam Smith in the studio to talk about The Ground We Won, which is going to be playing exclusively at the Melbourne International Film Festival for its very first screening outside of New Zealand, which is really exciting. So welcome.
Thank you.
To both of you.
Thank you.
Okay, so it's been described as a stunningly gorgeous, funny, against type tour through grassroots rugby union in New Zealand. First question is, are you rugby fans? That's what people want to know.
Well, no, we're not rugby fans and never really have been, which makes us a little bit of an oddity coming from where we come from. But, you know, we're really interested in, you know, why rugby is so important to, you know, our culture. And I think by extension, Australia as well. And I think internationally, you know, sports is a very important place in many cultures. Mm. So we're wanting to look at why that is the case and why it means so much to so many people, particularly in its sort of cultural, you know, what it offers in a cultural sort of realm. So, and you know, again, given the nation's obsession with rugby, it's remarkable, it's bizarre actually, that rugby hasn't really been explored on the big screen in New Zealand.
Not in this way, not as a factual
document. Well, barely at all, in fact. Yeah. I mean, yeah, there's a few projects here and there, but not in a really considered cinematic way.
Serious way.
Yeah.
And I think it was really important we were outsiders, because I think the reason why it hasn't been done is because it's just this assumption that, you know, rugby, when in New Zealand, it's who we are and it's, you know, part of us. But if you don't understand, you're from the outside. I mean, most people just, if you're not into it, you sort of run in the opposite direction. And we just sort of wanted to lean into it and explore it. And I think that's why it probably hasn't been done, because it had to come from outsiders, rugby outsiders, that were really keen to just get in there and actually just question it and find out what's going on. So, I mean, for us, actually, we always called it our man studies film. It was an exploration of this this sort of rural male, you know, hard man kind of culture in our country and exploring that. So sort of the central question of the film was always how within this context do we these men prove themselves to be a man to themselves and to each other? Mm. And so we went into went to a place called Reparoa in New Zealand, in the central plateau of the North Island. And so we spent a year living with these a rugby team of New Zealand farmers. All the guys are farmers, and the one team and the guys were aged 17 up to 44. And so we spent a year filming with them all their daily lives around the farm and stuff, and all their rites and rituals of the rugby club, like, you know, before the game, hyping themselves up, and after the game, drinking and partying, and then the bus trips and the, you know, so
the bus trips are pretty interesting.
Yeah.
And you think, oh, okay, yeah, that does happen.
Yeah, yeah. And well, that's an interesting thing. You know, we've had a cinema release in New Zealand, and we toured to quite a large degree with the film around the country. So from north to the south of the south, we got to talk to a lot of people from other rugby clubs, and they were absolutely, every single one of them were like, you know, that could have been our club. That is our club.
Yeah.
You know, it is indicative of the culture at large.
Fascinating rituals like the court session.
That was bizarre.
And this is a thing that
But believable, but kind of I've never seen that depicted before.
Yeah, and well, actually
it's very rare to have that recorded.
Is it?
By any means.
So explain.
Because it's private.
Can you describe what goes on?
Court session is this tradition within rugby, and I believe it's been happening in New Zealand for generations. I think the All Blacks used to do them before they got a bit more PC and tried to clean up the sport.
Right.
Essentially, I think usually it's twice a year, but it's often it's mid-season, at the end of the season, all the men sort of gather in the changing shed, and it's this ritual whereby you sort of, they hold a court, so the elders, like the, say the coach and people are like the
judges.
And there's all these sort of rules around the behaviour, but essentially people are called up for misdemeanours, they've, you know, maybe things they've done on the field throughout the season or outside of that. And then there's, you know, a punishment team. So that might be, you know, I don't know, sculling this or that or whatever. There's various punishments.
Consumption of chili and Weet-Bix.
Yeah, and it just turns into this mad ritual. And for them, the purpose of it is to try and, you know, from that point move on and have a clean slate kind of thing.
Yeah, okay. And also it's a bonding ritual thing. And
there's
a lot of drinking that goes on as well, and this male
bromancing.
I suppose it's modernly called.
And we were actually, I was just so interested in that, like, why is this drinking thing so, you know, mixed up, you know, so entwined with our rugby culture and our culture at large? I mean, it's not just people who play rugby that drink lots in New Zealand, I'm sure everywhere. But I think, you know, we lived with these guys, and they were we didn't live with them, but lived in their community. And, you know, just seeing, I think because they're not, there's no space to sort of be vulnerable, you always have to act, you know, coping, and everything's fine. And I think these guys are they all under huge pressures. You know, farming's really tough financially.
And there's a drought, is that right?
Yeah.
The background there, as I say it to Chris previously.
Yeah.
There's a little, not a throwaway, but kind of throwaway line that one of them says in a pub that something about, and when will they take it, you know, this drought seriously and we stop dying? I think it's alluding.
How many farmers have to hang themselves before you call
alluding
the drought?
Alluding to the suicide problem, which did you come across? Not directly,
but there were definitely things happening within the wider community that were connected with that sort of.
And I think actually part of what rugby clubs and those communities function is, you know, the guys that are actually coming down to be part of the team, a lot of it is just to be with one another, you know, like especially in stressful times like the drought, like that year they had the best numbers of players ever, and I think it's because guys, they needed to be around one another,
nothing to do, and
just sort of kind of they didn't well talk about it or just not talk about it, you know, just get off the farm. And so we learnt for, and I think, and that's part of like kind of cutting loose on a Saturday night after the game is like you've got all these pressures over the week and it's just this sort of valve that blows, so you can kind of it suddenly all became so much clearer why these all these things are sort of entwined.
It's a bit different over here, or you know, I guess in more urban environments you're blowing a valve because, I don't know, because you couldn't upload something on your Android or your phone bill got cut or something. But this seems a lot more intense and serious.
Well, I think too, it's, you know, this is a culture and it's probably the same in Australia to some extent that, you know, men aren't allowed to show their vulnerabilities, to talk about their innermost feelings. And so I think, well, I think it's unsurprising that you have this kind of numbing agent that is alcohol, very much entwined with that sort of those limitations on in terms of what it is or how you can be male.
And I think the game itself, you know, it's such a battlefield. It was a way for the men, like, they just get out there, they go for it, you know, it's like a...
Yeah, it's an analogue for war.
Yeah. And so they get out there, they support each other, they go through kind of hell together on that field. And then afterwards, all together, you know, they relax and celebrate. And it's like, there's a lot of kind of beautiful stuff within that, you know, into, as an outlet. As it's really complex, as well as it being kind of violent and stuff. Like, it's really fascinating.
It is really interesting. And you don't see a lot of female input or experience in the documentary itself. Was that deliberate or is it just the way it turned out?
It was deliberate, although I mean, we've always thought it was, we really want to explore this film as if from the male perspective, and also it was about their relationships with each other, as, so it's about sort of male bonding. So you do see women in the film, but they're peripheral to the story. And our three main characters... We would explore different phases of manhood, like Peanut's 17. And
he's like a very young sort of,
And then you've got like the, you know, the captain who's like life of the party but taking over the family farm and responsibility. And then you've got Calvin at the other end who's the solo dad to twin boys. And so we, all of their storylines, you know, it was just, it was about following them in their worlds. And throughout filming, we did always question, like, do we need to bring, you know, women perspectives into this and so on. And then we just got so complicated because you think, well, you need more than one person. They can't just be token. And
exactly.
So it would become like 10 hours long. So we just thought, let's just, you know, just focus on one thing and do it well.
Well, it certainly could be a television series. Couldn't it? Real reality television, but other stuff.
I believe you. The suggestion has been made.
Has it?
They're not satisfied with one film. They want it to continue.
You have to go around to every single rugby club in New Zealand now. No, that's the end of your life. But in a good way. That was interesting. I just thought, yes, I was looking at something that is quite rare to see today.
And that's the other thing. People aren't making
as many or that I've seen documentaries about what is a really strong male bastion, perhaps one of the last. And I also felt quite sad because it was like looking at dinosaurs. I know that might sound terrible, but it was looking at something that might become extinct.
It's certainly that culture and communities are changing, and they're doing so largely because the way farming is changing in New Zealand, whereby farms are getting bigger and bigger and more corporatized,
and sold fewer, overseas to overseas buyers, and
to some extent, or you know, or just big conglomerates buying up all these farms that used to be owned by, you know, say a dozen families.
Yeah.
So that has a big effect on who's left within the community. And so clubs like Reparoa, you know, they would have had four or five teams back in the heyday. Because there was that many people available to play. These days, and it's common throughout New Zealand, clubs are struggling to field one. And so, you know, and on top of that, there's you know, lots of other things you can do these days. Rugby isn't the only game in town. So
There's a league, there's probably AFL now over there, which is frightening.
Not quite, but...
sorry, but it is. And football, or your soccer.
Yeah. So where the club was, you know, the meeting place for the community, that community is a very different thing and is spread over, you know, different places. So in many extents it is I guess I don't want to say dying out, because I think it's more of a change than a something dying, but it is not what it once was.
Miriam, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, and I guess it's true. I think what was the film is, you know, it's black and white, and a lot of that was sort of looking at tradition, and the fact that these men, while the film is all sort of, it's all in the present day, well, the present day when we filmed it, which is 2013, the year that we lived with them, so much of how the men's behaviour and what they do and the rites and rituals have remained unchanged since, you know, when we're reading accounts of rural rugby teams in like 1905. And so I think that's really fascinating. So I think, on the one hand, while it seems like it might die out, it's like, well, it's kind of, people have been doing this for quite a few generations now. So I think, I agree with Chris, it's just
changing.
It's changing,
yeah.
But I don't think it will die out.
Yeah, it was sobering to watch it, though, to see, it still exists and people, it matters, you know, it seems to matter to the communities now, especially with those changes, as you mentioned, and the drought and how it's affected people. And there's some great scenes in there where it's raining and they're still playing rugby in the rain, and that is pretty cool.
Yeah, it was actually gorgeous at the, at the world premiere, because another woman in the community, we showed the guys the film before we locked the edit, but you know, the wider community all came to the premiere in Auckland at Civic. It was beautiful. Oh, and afterwards, like, the women from the farming community were like, they were so moved when the rain came and stuff, because they knew, they just felt like they felt it, you know, because it's
interesting.
It was lovely having a sort of a farming community that feel that sort of those transitions really deeply.
But also that separateness, like, those women had to see it in the film. They weren't a privy to going to those, you know, practices. Probably
that's
too busy, and they probably wouldn't be interested, to be honest. And,
I think they probably, it's their time.
But then they see it in cinema, they see it actually recorded, and it probably,
I don't think any of the women was surprised. I think, but it's definitely when the men go to bond together and have time out away from their families, I suppose, and the farm and things like that.
Interesting. Very interesting. Now, as far as the film from now on after Australia, where to next?
We're very lucky in that the film's screening next week. In fact, in Locarno, Switzerland, which is a really important festival over there, and we'll go on to screen in a number of other European festivals and actually in North America. We're not allowed to announce where they are just yet, unfortunately.
No, that's okay. So they're going to get around.
So it's travelling. And it's quite pleasing as well that most, I think, locations aren't really rugby-playing nations. So obviously there's something universal enough in the film for other people to connect with.
And do you think they'll get it about, you know, even the title?
Yeah.
Because it's actually got that very much war type of...
Yeah. Mm. Well, actually, the title was from a war memorial.
Okay.
Yeah.
Where was that? Was that in...
It was actually in Birkenhead. But it was more like, to us, it sort of symbolises, especially Reparoa, where we filmed, all that farming area was founded by returned servicemen after World War II. And there's lots of sort of road signs, anyway, all from, you know, different battles. And so we found it just sort of had that gravity and sort of the layers of meaning.
And the countryside around Reparoa was hard fought for land in terms of it was largely uninhabited, even from a Māori point of view, because it was scrub country, nothing grew, animals died. It was the bush sickness, and it wasn't until the 20s or 30s, I think, that they discovered that it was missing the trace elements like cobalt, which made it unproductive.
Okay.
So it was a very late area to be settled, but those first settlers had to walk off the land in most instances because nothing survived.
Nothing happened.
And it took a huge effort on the sort of national level to make that ground fertile. And now it's some of the, you know, the most fertile dairy country in New Zealand.
Yeah. So this film also must add may not be suitable for vegans to view.
Marin was a vegetarian when we arrived.
I was at I had been a vegetarian for like 17 years or something.
And then?
They changed me in about a week. I was going to like roast dinners and stuff. People have a very
That's
great...
what we call full immersion.
Yeah. Country hospitality. Well, it was wonderful, yeah. But yeah, there are a lot of... There are scenes. Of what do they call it?
Calfing.
Husbandry?
Husbandry. Animal husbandry.
Animal husbandry, yes. So men helping their cows...
So what was that like, filming that? Had you ever seen that kind of...
It was fascinating. Honestly, I could have watched that over and over.
Really?
Because I'm just amazed. The cows, their little hooves come out. And then, you know,
it looks incredibly painful. I mean, you're just feeling for the cow. You really are.
Yeah.
Well, and it's because it's black and white too, I think it's like makes you really...
It's quite powerful.
Yeah.
Intense.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. You know, calving begins at the tail end of the rugby season.
Yeah, of course.
So and it overlaps. So, you know, on top of what they normally have to do on the farm, they have to then be up around the clock checking on the cows to ensure that they don't get into trouble. Because, you know, if the calf...
How do they do that? Do they have a tagging device that alerts them, or
they just have to walk around the paddock, be it 2 a.m. or
get this knack for knowing the ones that need a hand, because often the calves just come out quite naturally and it's all fine. But they sort of be like, oh, that one's been sitting down a bit long or something, or that one's making a weird noise.
They're very good. Like cow whisperers.
Yeah. It's really, really impressive, actually.
Because
we'd walk around paddocks, and the only time I could tell if they caught that when one's on the go is when, you know, the hooves are sticking out, which is very obvious. But they can tell before that.
One of them didn't look like it was alive, but... They sometimes reanimate themselves.
Some just don't make it.
They don't make it.
Yeah, and the cow can die as a consequence. So that's why they have to intervene and try and make sure both.
Wouldn't want that job. Okay. No. But there is something primal about it, and really instinctual. You know, the instincts are there, and obviously that connection that they have after a few generations on that land. And yeah, you don't see that very often in documentaries or any filming, to be quite honest. True. I mean, there used to be in New Zealand, when I was in New Zealand, there used to be, probably not on anymore, but there used to be that...
Country calendar?
Yes.
It is still on.
It is? Oh, my God.
It's one of the most popular shows.
Are you kidding?
Highest rating show in New Zealand by miles.
Joking. Some things don't change, do they?
It's beautiful show, though.
That's amazing, isn't it? Yeah.
Country calendar.
Yeah.
They still have the dog. Same with
same
the dog.
Same thing, music. Yeah. Everything.
That's crazy. That is crazy. I remember they used to have the sheep rounding up the sheep. What was it called?
Magic.
Dog show. A dog show?
Dog trailer?
I think it was just called a dog
show.
A dog's show.
Yeah.
Bizarre. Even the name is like, that's normal.
Yeah.
These things aren't normal, are they?
Not to the rest of the world.
It's pretty compelling watching.
It is, watching them.
When you've got nothing else to do.
But there is a lovely scene. I don't know. One of the people comes in the documentary and he's just calling the cows at the beginning. Mm. And you go, right, okay, this is dairy country.
Mm. And it's hard work. Those men are working from often starting milking at 3:30 in the morning. And then they're working... You know, they might have a little break in the day, but then they're often working till it's night again. Like, they just work huge hours. And
then they play rugby.
Yeah, for their relaxation, they go into battle.
And to injure themselves.
Party all night.
Potentially serious injuries. Yeah. Really, there's no padding. There's no softly with that.
No.
It's crunch.
It's crunch.
And then watching the kids, is it... Calvin,
yes.
The solo dad, yeah. And he's a coach. It's hilarious, but it's also really quite touching and moving. And there's a scene there where he's saying to all the kids at the end, are they 10, 7?
They're under 8s.
Oh, they're under 8.
So they were 7 at the time, yeah.
Wow, 7. Would you put a 7-year-old out there? I'm just wondering, how does that go these days? Parents are so careful with their children.
This beautiful moment where Calvin actually had received a complaint from another parent from another team about the complaining about the rough and aggressive tackling that, you know, his team was doing. And Calvin was glowing with pride. He was like, well, I'm pleased. He was like, what do they think it is? Tiddlywinks? And he was thought,
that would never go down there anywhere. Yeah. In an urban, you wouldn't get away with that. You'd be, you know, wow.
That's right. And it's so, they see it. It's just.
Because even values. I was sitting there going, oh, that could be dangerous. And then I'm thinking, what am I saying? You know, this is crap. Like, it happens. What used to happen.
Injuries
as children used to happen a lot more. And
yeah, well, you know, I mean, I'd keep it at arm's length, you know, all my
Did
life.
Did you ever play?
No, I wouldn't go near it.
Miriam, did you ever play?
No. Yeah. I wasn't very sporty.
It was amazing, though, to see these kids, how they just loved it.
They seemed to love it. They seemed to love it. You know, and they seemed to be so informed about it, especially his sons. They're twins, I take it.
Yes, and they're rugby obsessed. You know, they sleep with their little rugby balls and they they're just amazing, always kicking them around the farm. And I think for Calvin, it's very much his philosophy on life. Like the things he can train them as a coach and as a dad is all kind of the ethics and the rules that are kind of wrapped up with rugby.
It's pretty amazing. And, I mean, he does an interesting thing, as I was going to say, where he gets them to pat each other on the back. And he goes, girls and, what does he goes, he or she.
Yeah, because it's one girl.
It's one girl. I was like, where's the girl? Oh, there she is. But that was cute and also really refreshing because you would think, oh, conservative and, you know, redneck or whatever, but not necessarily.
No.
Not just because it's rugby doesn't mean it's conservative.
That's right, yeah.
So the takeaways of you doing this, are you now watching rugby games?
Watching Riparoa games, for sure, but... yeah. I don't know. I think for me personally, you know, there's a sort of, like I say, I've kept rugby in all it involves at arm's length, you know, largely because I didn't fit in to that world. But I feel like through doing this, I've kind of made peace with a lot of that.
Interesting, yeah.
So, which wasn't, you know, the
Because it is the
goal.
Masculinity of most New Zealand, males.
Well, that's what's expected of you.
Aspirational,
And it's like, I think this is pretty limited as well. But I think, I can see why it's really important to a lot of people. And whilst I won't be choosing a lot of that myself, I get it.
Yeah.
So that's great.
That's good. To come to peace with yourself.
Yeah.
Well, for those who are listening, they probably don't get it. But it's a major thing in New Zealand.
Oh, totally.
Culturally, and even today. I mean,
absolutely.
When the All Blacks lose the World Cup, I believe the market crashes.
The nation mourns.
It can really affect the election and things like that. But yeah, it's massive.
It is massive. And Miriam, what about you?
Yeah, I guess I felt that, I just a deeper understanding and connection to our culture. Just, that I could understand it more. And and sort of warmth of feeling towards these guys. I just loved these guys and the community there. And what was, I think, rewarding to me about the film too, because we travelled around doing a Q&A, you know, with the film around New Zealand when it was out in cinemas, and we had sort of art house, townies come, art house cinema goers, and we also had rugby club people and rural farmers. And I loved that people who came from a rugby club or farming perspective just had this glow about them seeing the film, like they were seeing themselves on the screen and they'd never seen it.
Proud.
And that way that was just them, and you know, it wasn't in any way made PC or anything, it was just life. And I think what was so great was also people maybe from the towns who had have never been inside those locker room sheds or anything were maybe kind of horrified and in some ways confronted by many aspects of the world. Kind of, it was just an eye opener to them, and I think that was, for me, it was great to feel like there's this bridge, not like there's people in New Zealand, there's a chance to actually better kind of know ourselves and our culture. And so that was very rewarding for me. I mean, that's what happened to me personally, but I saw it also happening within the audience, which was cool.
Yeah, yeah, that's cool. Because it might only be like a degree or one generation away from a townie person having that rugby connection, but that's been lost, you know.
Mm. Yeah.
Like for my dad was a rugby coach, my grandfather was an All Black. But nobody followed it through because my brother, the only male, he was interested in cameras and art and things like that, and was like, Dad was very, very disappointed, but he used to drag me along to the matches because I said, yeah, I'll go. Because I just like watching strategy, and to me it's like it's interesting play going on, choreographic play that, you know.
Sure, yeah.
Type of thing. And, yes, watched a few matches, people getting beaten. Can't do that now. But I did notice that there was a bit of biffo.
Yeah, there's a lot of biffo.
There's always a bit of biffo.
Did you have to cut a lot of biffo out? No.
Not really.
Did it ever get really bloody? I mean, people want to know. Did it get bloody?
Actually, it was a bit of
biffo. It got big. I don't think it ever got bloody.
Brawling.
But,
it was more that just one particular game. It was like both teams were in it. Like, it was like the whole field was. It didn't last very long, but it was like, yeah. Wow.
It can just escalate quickly, can't it?
But I was always impressed because it seemed that truly, no matter what happened on the field, it was let go at the end of the game. And they would all go into the clubs afterwards. People would give the rituals of the speeches and the feeding the other team and the hospitality.
It's amazing.
It was always just left behind. And I was amazed.
That
is
good.
For myself, if someone had tried to beat me up, I think I wouldn't be getting over it in half an hour.
A few years later. That's interesting. And maybe those are the sort of things that we can take away from it, you know, that people can actually say, well, these are the really positive elements and these are the good things. That they blow the fuse and then it's like, it's done.
Yeah,
move on.
Yeah.
And it's within this sort of boundary of the game.
It's
which
a game.
Is the,
remember, it's a game, and to be reminded that it's just a game.
Yeah. And
none
of
these people get paid.
Yeah,
so we're looking at the amateur game as well.
Totally,
yeah. Just to remind people.
Yeah,
and you know we often joke that you know rugby's New Zealand's you know greatest religion.
Apart from sheep. Or
yeah, but
split ends.
And you know like the club president puts rugby down as his religion on the census form, and I know a number of them do that. But we found that you know, and I guess. In this our sort of secular age, where we don't have those rites and rituals as part of our, you know, day to day life, rugby, in this way, does fulfill a lot of that.
Yeah,
and it provides that transcendent from the daily grind. Because when you see those guys in that room, in that huddle, they're entering another state. There's like it's not of this earth,
and you open the film pretty much with that, and end it. So what's that? A year later, things have changed a bit.
That's right.
And yeah, so it's this beautiful. For me, that sort of took my breath away when I first saw that huddle, and them all coming together and like focusing on like all the things they're going to do in the game, you know, they sort of shout them out. But so these sort of ideals for these men, it's like, let's get out there, communicate, bag each other, you know, all these things that
very
they can then,
positive,
you know, take onto life, which is.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't think that. It was kind of like you kind of assume that they don't do that, they just go out there and do it. You don't really realize that it's very connected to each other. They do help each other. There didn't seem to be a lot of bullying present.
No, there's the hassling and the initiations.
The initiations,
and it's part of, I think, the beauty of this club that we chose, that they were really good-natured with one another.
Yeah.
I don't think we would have had the access if there'd been more, I don't know, darker things going on under the surface.
Now that could be another movie. That could be a horror film.
Yeah, we did want a good-natured team. Yeah, and they were gorgeous. Yeah.
But there's like a whole style of communication that exists in those four walls, within those four walls of the changing shed, that doesn't happen outside of that. And it is, you know, it is about communicating with each other and backing each other and letting, you know, mistakes go and carrying on and that kind of stoicism.
They'd be like
in a positive way, I think.
Quite rare.
And I loved all the things they shout in the field, like, leave your pain, tears for the shed boys or something, like there's all this sort of stuff. You're like, it's amazing what they kind of, it's beautiful.
Yeah. Now, were you allowed in the changing sheds, Miriam?
Well, it was really when we were getting to know them and seeing if it was going to be possible to make the film and kind of to test that we had access or see how they were. Mm. With that opening scene in the film, actually, which we never imagined would be in the film, it was just a test at that point. Right. We filmed their little huddle, pre-game huddle. Yeah. And I was in there because Chris is on camera and I'm the sound boom. And so they were, even at that point, pretty much oblivious to us because they're just focused on their...
How about all the steam from the showers?
It would reach a point where actually you're not seeing anything. And it's, I think it's kind of damaged something.
Yeah. But it does look effective, doesn't it?
But actually, after that, we did say to the guys, look, you know, we decided that I wouldn't go into the change sheds anymore because we thought they have to have at least some, you know, illusion of privacy. So we'd put up sound things. Yeah. But they were so relaxed. They were like, well, you're just going to watch the footage at home later anyway. You may as well come in.
Hilarious.
We let them have, I didn't go in there after
some
that.
Privacy. Yeah. Cool. Oh, well, that's wonderful. Cool. Oh, what next for you guys?
We've got lots of ideas of what we'd like to do next. Mm. Nothing in concrete just yet. Yep.
Because this is a labour of love, obviously, and you've still got festivals to do.
Still got
another
that
year,
to do.
Maybe.
Hopefully
6 months. Maybe
six
months.
Let's say 6 months.
Okay.
But yeah, we'll start developing our next projects. But yeah, ultimately we just want to keep making it's into these immersive documentaries, but also wanting to move into drama as well.
Excellent. I forgot to ask your backgrounds too. Chris.
My background was through cinematography.
Okay.
So actually I've been here to MIFF in the past with a number of films that I've shot for other people, directors. And I've shot lots of stuff for TV. I have a beautiful multi-TV series that I worked on for about 5 years, arts doco series. I've been cutting stuff as well.
In and control more.
And yeah, it was like, okay, I've done my dash. Serving other people's needs. It's time to make what I need to make and say what I need
what
to say.
What you want to say.
Mm. And that beautifully
worked
out.
And how did you guys meet and
well, we
get
met,
to work together?
We were sort of friends. We used to talk at parties. And I remember one party I said to Chris, I had this idea for this film. Our last film which we made is an immersive feature documentary film called How Far Is Heaven? And which we filmed at this little remote village called Jerusalem in New Zealand.
So that's about
that Wanganui River.
Yes, right.
With that film, and so Chris and I made that film together, and that we lived together in a convent, actually. Our film was about Sisters of Compassion, some nuns, and their relationship with the local Māori community.
Right.
Some bicultural kind of, and we're just exploring that relationship. So we made that film together, and that was actually my first documentary. I come from more of a writing background.
Right. Yeah. Okay, cool. Well, it's working. And it's good to see you both, obviously, on an equal...
Yeah.
Not one of you says, I'm the director and you're the sound person or vice versa.
Yeah, we have those titles, but it's actually pretty blurry.
Yeah.
And we have fantastically complementary skills.
Well, it works.
Yeah. And we seem to, I think it just works because we always, we seem to very easily share the same vision for a film. So it's quite harmonious in the making because we are just looking for how to sort of make that this happen. So that's... It just works really
make
well.
It happen in the best possible way.
And we just sort of work together to make that happen, and we have so it's been absolutely, it's been very fortunate pairing.
Great. Oh, cool. That's so great meeting you, and I wish you all the best of luck with the ground we won. It's certainly it's very pertinent, I think, for now and today, and because we do hear so much about what women in our communities go through and so on and so on. It's quite rare to see something that expresses what men are going through in smaller communities out there, whether it's New Zealand or not. I'm sure you could go to somewhere in America and it's a baseball team similar type of thing.
Mm. Yeah,
you know, those traditions that different nations have and different cultures. So the ground we won, yes, a delight. And I think people should go and see it for sure. It's playing Saturday, 8th of August, today at 1:30, and Monday at 9 p.m. So you can find those at the Kino on Saturday the 8th and Acme on the Monday the 10th. And it's playing alongside a little film called Clan, which is of interest probably to our community here at Joy. It's by Larissa Berendt, and it's Australian, and it's also got Indigenous content and queer content. Rejected by his family and struggling with his identity, a young man finds a new clan to belong to, Australia's first gay rugby union club, the Sydney Convicts. I think the Melbourne Chargers would be upset by that. They're the Melbourne equivalent. They'd probably go, what? Well, anyway, whether you're a Melbournian or a Sydney-sider, I think you'll enjoy that. It's 7 minutes of more rugby rucking fun. That was terrible. All right. Well, good luck again.
Thanks so much
for speaking to us here on Joy, Chris Pryor and Miriam Smith. Good luck.
Thank you for listening to a Joycast from Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.